Hello, everybody out there on the internet. Welcome to Weekly MTG, the only weekly Magic the Gathering Twitch show where you can pretend that you're actually at a weekly meeting. I'm Steve Sanu, here with, actually not Blake Rasmussen.
Not Blake Rasmussen. I'm so sorry. Yeah. I'm Daniel Ketchum, Senior Franchise Art Director for Magic the Gathering.
And Daniel has graciously agreed to step in this week to fulfill some hosting duties, so I'm very happy to have him here. And we got a lot to talk about. You can see the rundown at the bottom of the screen. You can also see our guests. We've got George Fan, game designer, who you might know from a pretty popular game I've heard called Plants and Zombies. Plants vs. Zombies.
Yeah.
Obviously, it's Plants vs. Zombies. We're very happy to have George here today to talk to us. And, of course, Mark Rosewater, who works on a game called Magic the Gathering, of course. So, George, a lot of people know you from Plants vs. Zombies, and if they don't, George was the designer of Plants vs. Zombies, a wonderful, wonderful game, or if you haven't played it, I highly recommend it. But you're also a really big Magic fan. In fact, you designed a Magic card for Magic 2015, right?
Yeah, it was 2015,
And that was Genesis Hydra, right?
Yes.
And I think we actually have an image of Genesis Hydra that we can show you. So this is a really cool card that sort of combines a lot of really interesting things that green does, big creatures, revealing cards on top of your deck so you can put a permanent into play. Tell me a little bit about how you got into Magic and sort of the path to having you design this specific card.
Okay, so we have to go all the way back.
Okay,
to
all right.
Revised.
Whoa!
Yeah, that's okay. When I started. And I think it was that, okay, so I was watching some kids from another school. This is back when I was in high school.
Sure.
And I was watching kids from another school playing this game, and it looked like they were having fun. So I was like, I want to know that. They're saying things like, I cast Shivan Dragon. I'm like, whoa, I cast Shivan Dragon. I want to cast Shivan Dragon too. Right?
So we've all been there.
Yeah, the game just looked really fun for some reason. I was just like, okay, we have to try that game because I can tell. I just felt like we were going to have a good time playing it. So I convinced two of my friends to each buy a starter deck. Mm-hmm. And at our next sleepover, we just, you know, at the beginning of sleepover, we had other activities too,
right?
But we ended up just playing Magic all night, right? And then the first card, the first rare I opened was Force of Nature. It was this green 8/8 trample creature with like the mana cost had like four green forest symbols in it.
Oh, sure.
And I was just like, what is this? Like 8/8, that's bigger than anything else. Like, I mean, I think they've gotten bigger Magic creatures since then, but yeah, that was the hugest thing you could cast back then.
Well, I mean, at the time, it was the biggest thing. It was the biggest thing.
So yeah. I was instantly drawn to that, and I was like, I have to cast this creature, and that kind of like started me on this path of like being a green mage through and through. Like that's like that made me drawn to green from the very beginning, and kind of like why later I designed Genesis Hydra as a green card. And so yeah, that was just like that's how it started. We instantly like got like. Like the game just like totally drew us in. We didn't know how to play back then. Everyone just like would open cards and add, like people would buy new packs, but people would just add to their decks. And they just play like all five colors of Magic. No one had any idea of like, oh, you could, you know, you only need to play 60 cards. You can just cut down to 60. No, like we just played like with stacks of like, we were playing Battle of Wits.
Right. I was about to say Battle of Wits was made specifically for your play.
And then you could tell who spent more money in the group by just how tall the stack was.
Because they got more booster packs. Yeah.
And I like to think I was the first person in the group because, you know, like the internet wasn't really big then. So I was the first person in the group like say, hey, you can cut down to just one or two colors and go for like a 60 card deck. And so it was like, once I did that, it was like an arms race. Everyone else in the group did that too, right?
Oh, we got to optimize.
Yeah.
So, Mark, tell us a little bit. The M15, for those who don't know, was a set where we invited a lot of different game designers design cards. What led to you wanting to have George be involved?
Well, basically what happened was the idea came out. I mean, this was not something I directly did, but I think Sean Main, which was somebody who used to work here, Sean actually was the person who was the contact person. And we came up with the idea of it'd be really neat to have outside people that don't normally design Magic. What if we went and had each of them design a Magic card? And so you were one of the first people I think they went to. And George, we knew George played Magic, and so we reached out to him and said, hey, George, you want to make a Magic card? And I think his answer was
like, of course. Like a dream come true. Yeah, it was.
Well, I think one of the coolest things about that initiative, right, is that all of, if you get the original M15 printings, your name is actually on that card.
It's designed by
George Fan.
Yeah.
As a Magic player since Revised, what was that like for you to see your name on a Magic card that actually came in a booster pack?
Yeah, designing a Magic card is something like I never thought would actually happen. Opening those packs, seeing like the name designed by George Fan, that was just like the best thing. It was just so cool.
Well, it's interesting that you should say that you never thought you would get designed. So not only have you designed a Magic card, now you're actually in the building as a contractor working on some of Magic's future stuff.
Yeah, it's like dreams coming true on top of dreams coming true. It's like I've awakened from, how does that work? Like if you're in a dream and a dream comes true, do you awaken from the, I don't know.
You're in a dream and it's awesome, things are happening. And then you wake up and realize you were in a dream, but that new thing's also awesome. Right. So it's just like nested dreams of awesome things.
Yeah, that's how I describe my time here. It's nested dreams of awesome things.
Nested dreams of awesome things. We should get pillows made. That's amazing. The other thing is, I think your work really influenced some of the folks in the building even before you got here, before you designed Genesis Hydra, even. Because, Mark, as I recall, there was a story about a card in original Innistrad.
Yes, I made a card in Innistrad. So one of the things I realized when I was making Innistrad was that there were zombies in Innistrad. And zombies in Innistrad were black and blue. And then it dawned on me that we could make something that had protection from zombies in green, because green was the enemy of both black and blue. And then I'm like, wait, it could be a plant. We can make a plant that has protection from zombies. And so we made it, and it was very exciting. I remember when I showed it to George.
I instantly went out and found 100 copies of that card. I still have 100 copies of Gray Bramble, because I was so tickled by that reference. That was so cool.
So it was one of those things that just kind of worked out perfectly in that. One of our favorite things when we do references is things in that it looks like a normal Magic card. You wouldn't necessarily know what it is, but if you know the reference, you get the reference, and those are really fun to do.
Yeah, I've always enjoyed looking for references in a lot of the games that I play, but Magic is always that special one where when you see the reference and you get the reference, it's so cool. And I think that's why, for me at least, Magic 2015 was so special to see those designed by cards, right? Mm-hmm. Because it wasn't just George, it was a lot of different people.
Oh, yeah, a whole bunch of people,
And that was just so cool. Let's talk a little bit about, as we transition forward, what is it that you are doing here for Wizards for Magic? I mean, I know you can't say too much.
No spoilers.
What are you doing here?
say very specifically to the internet on a live stream show exactly what... No, don't do that. But generally, talk about a little bit about what it is that you're doing here while you're a contractor.
So I think we've talked about this. I'm doing you guys are letting me do some of what you think I want to be doing the most, right? And we're mixing that up with hey, here's some stuff also which we think you can, your expertise can help us the most too. So I'm trying to do a mix of both. Nessa dreams of dreams coming true. That part is getting to actually design Magic cards.
Sure.
That's just that is the best thing ever. So I am on 3 different design teams, and
each at a different stage too.
That's the cool part. I get to experience the 3 early design stages. So there's exploratory, that's first. Mm-hmm.
We're doing fencing.
I'm on that team with you.
Exploratory. Doing,
and that mostly involves trying to come up with wild and crazy things because it's explored. That's when you can do that kind of stuff, and it's Mark telling me, no, we can't do that because of this. Maybe this shows some promise, that kind of thing, right? Mm-hmm. And then the other one of the teams I'm on is a vision design team.
The diving vision design.
Yeah, that was my first official design. I first got here and I was just kind of shadowing Mark, following him to meetings. And I went to a few design meetings for diving, and I always had to say, people were like, "What are you on?" I'm like, "Well, I'm not officially on the design team yet, but I've been going to a lot of diving meetings."
Yeah.
And that was the first time I could say, Mark officialized it at some point. It was
we had a team member.
I could say, yeah.
We had a team member that had to move off the team, and I realized there was an opening, and so I went and said, "Can George be on the team?" They said yes, so I said, "Okay, George, it's official."
He was going to all the meetings anyway.
So. Yeah.
But that was the first time I felt for real. I could just say the shorter sentence of, "I'm on the design team for diving," which was super cool. And then the last one, there is a set that seemed like very, very cool to me, and I was like, oh man, I really want to work on that. So I kind of like started also going, going to every single one of their play tests, right? Yeah. And then that ended up being Cricket, which I'm doing. I'm on the set design team for, rounds out all. Like I get to experience all facets of like design at all different phases.
So the strategy of being on Magic Design Teams is just show up to the meeting so they eventually say, okay, you're on the team.
You just keep showing up till eventually like they just give up and they say, yep.
You've been here for enough meetings, you know enough.
But yeah, so George right now is on exploratory, he's on a vision design, he's on a set design.
That's awesome.
Yeah. No play design for George though.
No, I don't think I'm decent at magic, but I don't think I'm good enough to be on the play design team.
Well, the important thing is that you are here, you're designing stuff, you're doing what you like, and I personally would love to see what a play design by George Fenn would look like.
The green cards are really good.
Yeah. Yeah. I know. I'll just like subconsciously boost all the green. That's kind of what, yeah.
So we've talked a little bit about your magic beginnings. Let's talk about your game designer beginnings, because sure. I'm always curious when we talk to people both inside and outside of the building, how they get started on the path to becoming a game designer. I'm sure a lot of our viewers are interested in that too. So how did you become a game designer? Like when did you start designing games, and when did you consider yourself to be, in your mind at least, a game designer?
Okay, so we can go all the way back.
Yeah, let's go all the way back.
In the beginning.
George. His father bought him an Apple II computer.
All right.
And I started playing games on that, and I realized, hey, it kind of like the programming language on Apple was very much exposed. It was BASIC. So it was called BASIC. It wasn't a basic.
Right.
Right. We knew what you mean,
And, you know, being a kid and being kind of like naturally like, you know, inquisitive, and I just kind of like explored like making little games in BASIC. They were not good at all.
What was the first game you made?
One of the first ones was this game called George Fans, Are You Dumb? Okay. And all it was it would ask you on the screen, are you dumb? if you press no, it would ask you again, are you dumb? and if you hit yes, it would repeat over and over. You are dumb, you are dumb, you are dumb, you are dumb, you are dumb. Yeah. I've advanced pretty far early game design. Yeah. So that got me into kind of like, okay, well, here's how you, because I also kind of like, there was this magazine called 3-2-1 Contact back then.
Oh, yeah, I remember 3-2-1 Contact.
You could copy the code out of the back of the magazine and like kind of learn how like games work, like very, very small games work. So that was that. And then also there was, because I was just, you know, I just loved games ever since I can remember. So there was this plan, me and my best friend in third grade, we had this plan. We were like, okay, while everyone else is like playing handball on the playground, we would, you know, sequester ourselves and have like binders and paper, and we were like, let's design some like video games, right? Because back then video games were more like, these are things like kids play, like grown-ups weren't really, like that was like the kind of the start of video games, and a lot of games were like, here's stuff for kids to play. It hadn't been accepted as like a thing grown-ups can play like widely yet. So we were thinking, okay, grown-ups don't know what kids like, but we don't know how to program. So like for real, right? So
yeah.
So let's design games so when we grow up, like let's design games as kids so when we grow up we can use these designs.
Oh wow.
And make them, because we know what kids like.
That
right?
Shows a remarkable amount of foresight. Like that's wow.
So if I go to your desk right now, will I find like the binder?
And that's how Plants vs. Zombies came to be.
So I don't think my creativity fully, okay, so my friend, all of the designs were like really creative and awesome. Mm-hmm. Like there is one where it's like, it was called Refrigerator Raid. And you know, it was like you were an ant and you would go into a refrigerator and fight like all the different kinds of food inside the refrigerator. And then the sequel, you were a banana and a strawberry, as a two-player co-op game, and you were fighting against the ant. So it was like, they had some like cool stories to them. All of mine were like take George's favorite game at the time, change the name, and innovate like a little bit.
Yeah.
So one of my favorite games was Contra, and then when you played Contra,
yeah,
and
it
was
absolutely.
Like basically like Aliens plus Rambo, and it was just like super, super awesome side scroller, right? Mm-hmm. My game was called Massacre. And it just starred these two buff dudes running through the jungle with machine guns, shooting at aliens also. So it was pretty much Contra.
Sure.
Yeah. Except my innovation was you would get locked into a room, okay? And aliens would come jumping at you from all angles, and then it would flash on the screen, Massacre Zone, Massacre Zone. Okay, but the awesome thing is, like, Contra, the series didn't start off very silly.
Right.
It got more silly as time went on. Mm-hmm. To the point, okay, so in my level designs for this early, for Massacre, I had the stage where you're going through the desert and you would ride on these robot camels, which is kind of outrageous, right?
Really great, actually. It sounds awesome.
We've gotten to the point in Contra where Contra has robot camels.
Well, you were just ahead of your time then. Yeah, that's really what it
like,
was.
Like I said, I was making these designs and saving them for, a later point. So then, that was like very early on, and then I grew up, and I had a college degree in one of the three things my parents would deem acceptable, which is computer science, right?
Sure. Yeah.
That's legitimate for my parents, and but going into it, I didn't realize like. So I started off college as a pre-med, and I had no idea. I thought computer science was like more like, I was so naive. Like I thought computer science was more like, here, do electrical engineering, like mess with like microchips and stuff. Mm-hmm. I didn't realize computer science, like programming, is just what I was doing back when I was a kid with like messing around with BASIC, right?
It was more complicated. George fans, you are dumb.
Yeah. And so it took me basically failing my organic chemistry class and having to like reconsider what I'm doing, because that was one of the other paths. Like the three things were acceptable is like to be a doctor, mm-hmm. or to be a programmer, or and to be a lawyer. I think those were the three things my parents would have been okay with, and I failed being a doctor, so I was like, what else can I do? And I was like, oh wait, programming is like something I like doing anyway. So the last half of college was me like getting a computer science degree. And then so what drew me to games was that like, so I've been all over the board. Like when I was a kid, if you'd ask me what I wanted to do, I'd say like I wanted to be an artist. So I spent a lot of time drawing, mm-hmm. when I was a kid. Mm-hmm. At some point I wanted to be a musician, I thought. And and then games is a way like for me to kind of like combine all these things I love and to be able to like kind of had the skills matter in each. Like, so starting out in the games industry, I was actually a programmer. But I got to do a little bit of art, a little bit of music here and there. And then when I transitioned to becoming a designer was just when it was another thing of like, you know, George, you're not that good of a programmer, but you can design pretty well. So it's just a matter of like finding what you're good at, right? Like, So yeah, that's kind of how I just like this weird path of ending up as the designer. I mostly just focus on design nowadays. So
So you we're gonna obviously Plants vs. Zombies is probably your most well-known game. But I discovered your work when we talked about this previously on a little game called Insaniquarium.
Yes, that little game.
The whole concept of this game. I love this game. Is you're like feeding fish. Like that's basically the game, right?
Yeah, you feed fish, you fight aliens, and then the fish in this game poop money. So that's all you have to know. That's all you have to know. Yeah.
So you were PopCap and Insaniquarium, then Plants vs. Zombies, which became sort of a runaway success.
Yes. I don't think I could have ever predicted how crazy like big it was going to become. Like, I think if you think that like, if you think that any of your games are going to be that big, it's just like, I don't know. You can't, right? It's just unfathomable.
Right.
And so while we were making it, it was like, even the people at PopCap, they're like, who, like, what is this game, right? Like, it's so weird. It's a weird game, but it was even weirder for, like, what PopCap was doing at the time. Like, what is this game with, like, why are zombies fighting plants, right? That seems so random. And it was, like, it was more, like, because PopCap's really known for their casual stuff. It was more hardcore than any, like, it's not a hardcore game, but it's like leans toward that side more than any PopCap game before it.
It was a level above sort of what they were doing at the time.
Yeah. So I think it was a surprise to everyone in PopCap, like how well that game did.
I always think it's really like, it's obviously, Mark, you Grave Bramble modeled after the Plants vs. Zombies, yeah. But I think it's interesting that people were thinking like, who is this? Like, why are plants fighting zombies when in Magic that happens literally every day? It's like, why is a merfolk holding, like, driving a car while holding a sword and, you know, attacking a, like, magical being that is an ally to your opponent on the battlefield? Why is that happening? And it's just like, no, it's a game. That's why, right?
And before that, before Grave Bramble, yeah. I remember really liking the Golgari.
Yeah.
Guild, because they had literal, like, I think Shambling Shell was one.
Yeah.
Like, the creature type, plant, zombie, I think.
Yeah. Oh, right, yeah.
George and I were talking about the conflicts of the colors, and it dawned on us that the black-green conflict is plants versus zombies.
Oh, yeah. I raised my hand, I'm like, I have a suggestion.
And then, so you did Plants vs. Zombies, very, very successful, and you also did Octogeddon, too, right?
Yeah, that came about, I started doing game jams, and one of them I did was Ludum Dare. That's a 48-hour game jam where one person has to make a complete game in 48 hours.
Oh,
and it appealed to me because, remember how I was saying I like to do like the art and music, too? So that would make, like, in 48 hours, one person has to do the art, the music, the programming and the design for a game, right?
Does that sound as hard as it is that actually as hard as it sounds?
So making a game takes many people many years.
Yeah.
So coming up, it's like, I mean, like other, so for instance, the equivalent of, like, they have game jams for like music kind of things. The equivalent of that would be coming up with a piece of music in 30 minutes, like, or an hour, they would give you that.
Wow.
So a game in 48 hours is, yes, like, that is, like, you have to keep the scope really small, obviously. Mm-hmm. Your game's not going to be super polished. You just have to come up with, like, the nugget of what's fun. So the way they keep you honest is they give you a theme at the beginning of the jam. And the theme we got for that one was evolution. So I don't know why I just instantly thought of, okay, I want to make a game where you start off with just a few of something and then you keep adding more and more to that. And I just came up with the idea, I don't know why my brain thinks this way, of an octopus with two tentacles, and the upgrade track is you evolve like more and more tentacles. So you go from two to three to all the way up to eight, and that's like the full octopus, right? Mm-hmm. And so you have this octopus with two tentacles, and I think a space I'm familiar with is like the defense space. So.
Right.
I was like, okay, what's going to happen? There's going to be submarines coming at you from all sides, so you kind of have to sit in the middle and defend against them. Hmm. It's kind of like a bizarro tower defense, if you think about it, like where instead of having the five lanes in Plants vs. Zombies, it's like each arm is one of the lanes, kind of. So you can blow up submarines, collect DNA points, which you can use to buy upgrades for your arms, so you can get, like, the theme is evolution.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I was like, why not just evolve one of your tentacles into a snake? So, and then it shoots venom at the submarines. It's the pea shooter of Octogeddon, right?
All right.
And then I was like, what would look cool on an octopus? Like a snake in one hand and a lobster claw on the other, right? So
yeah.
I was like, I had a lobster claw. That's kind of like the chomper. It's a close range heavy damage.
So you just kept being like, what would look cool on an octopus tentacle?
That's part of it. Yeah. I wanted to get an elephant trunk in there, kind of like, so
that's awesome.
Like, that's like blows the submarines back.
Yeah.
And so I did that in 48 hours, and then I showed it to some friends, and they were saying like, hey, this is really like, they played through the thing, and then it kept kind of playing. So I was like, maybe there's something, like, I like to have like a core of like a prototype of what's fun before I started working on it more, because I feel like getting a game to that point, and just like having the base of the game be fun is such a hard thing to find. So I haven't worked on a game yet where I don't have the core of what's fun yet. I imagine that would be really hard. I don't know how other people do it, but the thing you have isn't like fully formed yet, so you keep, the fun isn't there right away. And I know games. Some games are made this way, and then you kind of like pray and hope that in completing the game and adding all the elements that are supposed to be there, the fun will appear at some point when everything meshes together. Yeah. But I generally don't work that way. I like start really with like a simple framework, and I make sure that's already fun, and then I just build on that because I kind of like it sets a path that I know at the very least it'll be at least this fun, right?
Yeah, that's a really interesting approach, I think, because and that's a really good transition to the next thing that we're going to talk about, which is game design.
Yeah.
And everybody obviously has different approaches to game design. And here's the thing, guys. There's a Q&A thing at the bottom there. If we have time, we will absolutely take some questions for George and Mark. If you have them, please put them in the Twitch chat. We've got people monitoring. But talking about game design specifically and approaches to that, George, you just told us sort of what your approach is. You start with that nugget of fun and you expand out, which is really cool.
That's a great deal, yeah. Start with the fun.
Yeah. Yep. Makes sense. Mark, in your experience as a Magic designer, has that also been sort of where you start out with?
Well, I mean, I'm in a different... My job is to take a game that's already fun and make new versions of it. So, yeah. Like, I don't have to make the fun of Magic is pretty baked into Magic. So, I mean, I'm always trying to figure out how to make it different. Mm. So there's a different set of skills of take the same game and make variations of it versus make a brand new game. Mm-hmm. So, like, in some ways, George and I work in very different areas where, like, I'm like, okay, it's time to make the 100th version of Magic. Why is it different this time?
Yeah, and how do you keep it?
Yeah, how do you keep it fresh? And, like, so a lot of what Magic's about is, look, the core... It's not like Magic's not fun. The core of Magic is really, really fun. It's just how can we layer stuff on top of it? How can we do something that's a new twist on things? So it's a little bit different. I agree with George that when you start with a brand new game, like you want the fun front and center. When you're building on a game that already kind of has the fun baked in, you start focusing on some other stuff. So when I start a game, or expansion, for example, it's like, well, what makes this expansion unique? Why is this thing not just something we've seen before?
Sure.
So that's different.
I mean, I think not only is that different, I think it's cool that Magic already has that nugget of fun. So when you came into the building, it was like, oh, I already know this game is fun. Now all I have to do are like the other things that I would normally do.
Yeah. Magic is like one of the most fun games I've ever played. And so like, yeah, getting to build on top of that, in some sense, it feels like, wow, what can I even do to make this game like better? It's almost like, wow, I don't really know where to go because there's almost no, like, Magic is already such a great game, so it's like really kind of, it's been more challenging than I expected to kind of find like new things that are like just as good as what's been done before but just feel fresh too.
And the other thing that George is experiencing this is, like, George will come up with an idea and like, oh yeah, 6 years ago we did that. Or, you know, we tried that 9 years ago on this set. And we, you know,
it all seems fresh to me, but it's like, oh, you guys have already done that and you already know how that ended up. So, yeah.
Talking a little bit more generally, what do you look for or what do you consider when you're designing a good video game versus a good tabletop game? Like, what principles are similar? What principles are different? What do you look for when you consume it? That sort of thing.
Yeah. So, a key difference is like in tabletop versus video game. In tabletop, every time you have to add any like bookkeeping kind of things, like you have to be very careful about that, right? Mm-hmm. You can't go overboard in that. You have a lot more leniency when you're doing video games because the computer like keeps track of everything for you. And so something that I've been like Magic, because it's played as, you know, a tabletop game or like a card game in front of like, you know, a real game in front of people, like you kind of have to make sure you're not overdoing like the bookkeeping mm-hmm. aspect of it.
Sure.
So whereas like a video game, you probably wouldn't think, oh, I can't, you know, it's tricky if I have counters and tokens in the same set,
sure,
but
sure.
Or like on too many cards in the set. But yeah, you just have to keep track of like, okay, is too much, because it's really easy to like have the player spend too much time fiddling with their dice or tokens, and then it kind of breaks the flow a little bit of the game. And when you're like, okay, what was I doing again? You start before you attack, you're like, let me cast a bunch of things. And you're like, hey, what was my attack going to be again? Because you want to keep that flow going. Whereas in like video games, you have to worry about that a lot less. In video games, it's really hard to make a tabletop game that has to do with like Twitch reflex kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. Any video game with action, it's hard to translate to like a board game, right? Strategy is like a lot easier to do, but anything that requires like reflexes or like, okay, if you don't do this before a certain time, or like a lot of platforming kind of concepts don't translate over. Something that tabletop games can do is like the social element is a lot easier to come by. I'm an indie developer, and my teams are usually like three people, right? So yes, there are multiplayer game experiences, but usually that's why a lot of indie games are usually more single player experiences, because once you go multiplayer, you have to build like, you just need a bigger team usually, and you need like to build that back end and everything. And even then, it's like a lot of like, it's so easy to design like a tabletop game with like that incorporates like a cool like social experience, like you like banter, like you like trying to decide with your teammates what you're gonna do, or like having moments where like, oh, you're all laughing around the table because something funny happened in the game, whereas like that is a lot harder to do in video games, at least in the indie space for sure.
I have not really made any video games, so I'm much more well versed in tabletop. But one thing I know that we worry a lot about from tabletop, I mean, we make magic in digital forms. And so a lot of what we do is we talk about what works in digital and what works in paper as far as the magic experience. And what we find is very interesting is there's certain things that work really well on tabletop that digital magic has trouble with. And there's certain things that work, like it's hard for tabletop to do it, but digital magic does it really well. And so that for us, there's a delicate balance because magic has to exist in both worlds.
Right.
And so like, we can't make it so tabletop friendly that it's not video friendly. We can't make it so video focused that it's not tabletop friendly. So there's a gentle balance we have to reach there.
That was a surprise to me. I heard people say like, that's not going to work in very well in digital. I was like, oh yeah, like I hadn't even thought of it that way. So an example is like something with like that could trigger on all different creatures or something like that, and you have to basically go through all creatures or anything like whereas in tabletop you would just instantly, like, you wouldn't even bring up all those prompts, right? An example of something.
One of the things we talk about is, like, how many clicks something is.
Yeah. Oh, sure.
Like, sometimes we'll make an effect, we'll go, oh, that's, like, four clicks. Yeah. Which is, I mean, on a video game, that's a lot of clicks.
Yeah.
Because one of the things that's interesting on a tabletop is, like, humans are really good at certain things and not great at others, and computers are really good at some things. Sure. And so, like, there's things that computers are great at that humans aren't good at, and that's better for video. But there's things that humans are really good at that computers aren't particularly strong at. Like, the computer has to be very logical. So humans will just jump over things that don't make sense. And so we can do things in tabletop where, like, oh, no, they'll get the gist of it, it's okay. But once you apply it to, like, once you have to spell it out and have clicks, it just becomes so complicated. So it's really weird how some things are easier in tabletop, some things are easier in video. They're just different kinds of things.
Yeah, I hadn't even considered it going the other way.
Yeah,
that's really neat.
So you've both been doing this for a long time as your career, designing games, which is really cool. How do you feel like game design has changed in the last 20 years?
Well, here's the first big thing: I'm a little older than George. when I was a kid, you didn't tell people you played games. It was like kind of something that you and your fellow game players knew that you played. But I mean, like, socially, like, it wasn't, you weren't proud of your game playing. It was kind of like, you know, it wasn't something where game playing was seen as this tiny niche thing. And flash forward to now, we're like, I'm a gamer, loud and proud. Everybody, like, there's a stat I saw where they asked boys and girls age, I think it was 12 to 18, have you played a game in the last 30 days? Of the boys, 99% said they had. And of the girls, 94% said they had.
Wow.
And so the point is, like, everybody plays games. I mean, sometimes on the phone, whatever. I mean, there's different ways to play. But, like, it's not like, oh, is playing games this odd niche thing? Everybody plays games. There are different kinds of games. But, I mean, everybody plays games. And that's one of the biggest differences is, like, you can just, I play games. You can be proud of playing games. It's not, that's such a different world. Where if you go way back when, it was sort of like something you did, but you didn't do it in public, or it wasn't something that you were, you didn't like announce, hey, glad to meet you, I'm a gamer. That wasn't something you tended to do. So that to me is one of the biggest differences. The other major difference is technology.
Sure.
You know what I'm saying?
Sure.
Like George was saying earlier about how when he started playing, like the internet wasn't really a thing.
Yep.
Like when Magic started, like I remember when I traveled from Los Angeles to San Francisco, and in San Francisco, there were cards that they wanted to trade for that no one, like no one wanted in LA, but they really wanted them in San Francisco because the metagame in San Francisco was just different. And the idea, like, why would you want that card? Because the internet wasn't really a thing yet. And so they was very like localized. But now I make a deck people like, somebody in Singapore can see it and play it. You know, like it's so universal. And I think the technology and the communications has had a huge impact on how games work.
In terms of design, does that, does that present a little bit more of a challenge knowing that there's so much shared information now that people could very much figure out exactly how to, like crowdsource how to best play the game or how to best conquer a level? Has that caused any frustration, or has it just been another welcome challenge to continue to up your game?
I can think of an example that does show like, okay, here's a sign of the times, how things have changed. So in Diablo 2 to 3, they changed how the skill system kind of worked. Mm-hmm. Where in Diablo 2, like once you allocate one of your skills, it's just like permanent, you can't undo it. One of the reasons they did it the way in Diablo 3 is because information is so prevalent that people just look up the best builds anyway. Mm-hmm. So they kept the skill system in Diablo 3 a lot more freeform, where you could just respec pretty much for free, mm-hmm. and you could, you know, you can change this skill to this one just to experiment. It lets you experiment more, which I think it's because, like, if it's permanent these days, you just go look it up, right? If it's freeform, maybe it's more work. Like, maybe there's some fun in experimenting. Maybe it's more work to, like, you know, tab out of your game to go to, like, look up the best build. Or there's some people that might enjoy, like, I want to find out the best build on my own, right? And that's just, like, that is an example of, like, something that's a sign of the times. Like mm-hmm. that design changed from, one, you know, I think there were, like, 10 years between, at least, mm-hmm. between Diablo 2 and Diablo 3. And so, yeah, that's an example of, like, here is how one aspect of design has changed since information became a lot more, like, distributed between everything.
So another real famous example. So the original Minecraft, the very first Minecraft, when you played, even the concept that there were recipes, like you had to figure that out. It wasn't something that was a known thing. Yeah. You know what I'm saying? And the idea, like, now it's like, oh, well, let me tell you the recipes. But like when you, I remember Ken Nagel actually played, I mean, he was playing Minecraft like the first month it came out, yeah. and he was describing stuff to us. And he was like trying to learn things as he played because it had never happened before. You know, like, oh, I did this and all of a sudden this happened. And like, I didn't even know you could do that, you know? And that, like the idea of the discovery, which was just possible, like even, you know, Minecraft, what, 10 years ago, 15 years ago? I mean, not even that long ago. And like, it just, you could explore, and now it's like, you would look it up 2 seconds later. There's no, well, we might as well tell you the recipes because that's not, mm-hmm. you know, the discovery of them is not going to be part of the game.
Sure.
And so that is a huge difference.
Yeah, in Minecraft, yeah. like,
I remember also if you played in those first months, you had people would direct you to this YouTube video mm-hmm. telling you, here's how you survived the first night in Minecraft. Mm-hmm. I think if that video didn't exist, there'd be a lot fewer people playing Minecraft. So, like, that's another example of, like, okay, like, the internet makes... Well, I think maybe they were thinking, like, on one hand, they wanted people to do the discovery, but mm-hmm. it was so, like, what do you have to do first? You have to use your hand to punch a tree. Like, that's not very, like, intuitive, right? So that's something that requires you to, like, watch a video. The video tells you, oh, press, you know, go up to a tree and punch it to get wood from it. So, like... Maybe because the people who made Minecraft knew like the internet would just spread information like this. That's how it could that's how they could get away with, you know, not including something that is, you know, openly taught the player how to start the game.
Sure.
Right. So yeah.
Well, yeah, that's a lot of and like design is you guys work on some great design, and we have another different kind of design that we want to show off today.
Oh, segue.
Check out that segue. Look at that segue. Yeah, we have some really cool things. I'm sure people noticed here on the table that we've got a little play space set up, and we're showing off some minis from our friends at WizKids, the Creature Forge miniature line. And these are some pretty cool creature miniatures based off of the creature tokens of Magic, right, Daniel?
Indeed.
So the things that the ones that we're showing off today, we have three new ones and two ones that have already been seen. So in the upper part of the screen there, you can see the soldier token, which has already been seen. That's based off of the Scars of Mirrodin soldier token. So mark and point to it. There we go. Yep. And then in the center there, we've got goblin tokens. Those are based on the Shards of Alara Jund goblins. And then at the very bottom, we have zombies, which are based off of the creature token from Amon Khet. So yeah.
Brains.
So and then you can see we're slowly panning over to you can see in the on the side of the screen there we've got Sapperling tokens. Those first showed up
what
in
what sound does a sapperling mean?
That I don't know, you're the plant expert here, George. What do plants
mean? The sound of a sapperling falling in the forest.
If nobody's around
flat,
it here.
I don't know what's around. Yeah.
So yeah, these are all made by WizKids, and they're gonna be coming out in September in randomized packs, and there will be 28 figures in total.
So many.
Which is a lot. A lot of figures in total. $3.49 of MSRP, and those will be available, like I said, in September, and you should inquire at your local game store to see if they're gonna be available in your area. So, Daniel, you work on the franchise team.
I do.
And this is a project that's very much in the franchise team's purview, right?
Yeah, because the franchise team, we're primarily concerned with efforts of expanding Magic beyond the card frame, and this certainly qualifies.
So the thing is, it's difficult to see on the shots we have. We're getting up as close as we can without really, really getting in out of focus. But the detail on these figures is actually pretty amazing.
I am so pleased with how they turned out. Yeah. I mean, Matt Danner and I have been working with WizKids to figure out exactly, what would be the best art to translate into tiny little figures. I didn't realize they were so small.
Right, yeah. But
because we always talked about, like, how, you know, the size. Oops, did I just pull this out of frame?
No, you're fine.
How big these would be. But I'm shocked at how tiny they are, yet how detailed they are.
Yeah,
I think they did a really nice job. Transferring all the detail from the art into these sculpts.
So it's really tough to see on camera, but when everybody out there, if they do pick them up, and you actually pick them up and look at them, the level of detail on the paint, we were saying before the show, is just amazing. If you get this goblin token, for example, you can see that there's a little, I'm gonna see if I can get my hand in frame a little bit here. You can see this the skull that he wears as a hat. Under the skull, there you can see his eyes, and it's again tough to see on camera, but there are little red pupils in the eyes, and that level of detail is just really, really cool, I think. So we wanted to display the figures this way, at least partially to demonstrate what they look like in a play environment, but also to show that they can be used for a lot of different things, right? Obviously, if you want to put these on top of your creature tokens when you're playing Magic, if you have you know, a planeswalker that summons zombies and you want to make a little tutu zombie, you can use these for that, but you can also use them for miniatures in a tabletop game. You can they would look very good just as on your desk if you wanted to show off your Magic fandom that way.
We put some care into making sure that, I don't know if the Alara goblin or whatever is the most iconic goblin, but one of the things we were careful about is knowing that they would be small, is making sure that the different art that we picked would yield very different silhouettes, so that at size or on a table, when you've got a whole bunch of different characters, you could easily parse them and keep them, and, you know, tell them apart just at a glance. And so I'm really, really pleased that that was the case and that they came out this way.
Yeah, and to be clear, some of us have, at least I only saw these for the first time this week as they came in for the show. We were focused on the goblins again here, but you can really see how detailed they are in that shot. Even at a glance, and that's Mark's hand moving them so that you can sort of see that this is indeed live.
Sweet. How many of the so this is it? We've only revealed these five of the 28.
As far as I'm aware, I know that the soldier and the spirit, which Mark will move into frame. That's the spirit from Shadows Over Innistrad.
That's the spirit.
Yeah. yes, we like to have fun. We like to have fun. But yeah, it's amazing the level of detail on these figures, and I think the franchise team did a great job at making sure that they would look very. When you look at these, you can tell which art that it is an art from a creature token.
There's one. There's a couple that I'm very excited about, and so hopefully you'll learn about them soon, so I can talk about them ad nauseum on Twitter. But we obviously zombie goblin. We tried to key in on some creature types that tend to show up a lot. So in those 28, you get a good variety, but there are a few in there that I'm, yeah, especially
excited. But yeah, like we said, 28 different figures, randomized packs, coming out in September. So please inquire at your local game store so that they can order them for you, and you can have your own play space with cool Magic token figures. It's really great. So thank you so much to WizKids for providing these for us to show off. I'm very, very happy to get to show a cool thing on the stream.
Yeah.
So we're going to go ahead and move over to Q&A, and I've been routed a couple of questions from our Twitch chat. We don't have time for a whole lot of them, but so George, this one is for you. What is your favorite draft set of all time, and why? And I think this is actually a good question for all of us, too, to talk about our favorite draft sets, but George especially.
So, have you heard of a draft set called Rise of the Eldrazi?
Of course, you heard of Rise of the Eldrazi.
Well, you know, remember how I was infatuated with, like, the 8-8 Force of Nature?
Yeah.
Try 15-15 in the set, right?
Yeah.
It was just like, okay, I heard it described as Battlecruiser Magic, right?
Sure.
Where you can just turtle up, make, like, build some walls, early defense, and then just, like, have, like, you know. In Rise of Eldrazi, when you cast an 8-8 Annihilator 1, the game's not over. That's just, like, the beginning of the game. Like, and then you wait for your opponent to cast the next big thing, and then you're just, like, haymaker after haymaker. And I thought that was, you know, that the excitement level was so epic. And I just, like, yeah, big creatures. I'm, like, you know, a good, decent amount Timmy. So I love big creatures in general. So yeah, and I felt like it was, you know, a really well balanced set, had a lot of other strategies to try. Like there was a Defenders theme, you could go level up. You could do like, I think it was like Magic does a lot of instants and sorcery matters now, but it was one of the early, like you could draft a Kiln theme with Distortion Strike and rebound it and just like attack, you know, for unblockable turn, like you know, for two turns in a row. So yeah, I think that's gotta be my favorite draft set. I made a cube for that set so I could relive it, but I could also put on my designer hat and go, I think I wanna, you know, I can tweak it a little bit to like make it even awesomer. Like so yeah, that's my answer for best draft set of all time.
Okay, so opening up a random any random pack of Rise of the Eldrazi, what card are you most happy to see? For pack one, pick one.
If I want to win, it's Eldrazi Conscription.
Okay, all right.
Seems good. Yeah. Seems good.
All right.
Because it keeps me open, and it's just insane. Like, that's...
I have fond memories of casting Eldrazi Conscription in Rise of the Eldrazi Limited. Mark, what about you? Favorite limited environment of all time?
Well, I've been playing Magic since the very beginning.
Yes.
So nostalgia is very high for me, and complexity does not scare me off. So I really, really enjoy Time Spiral Block.
I've drafted Time Spiral. It's a lot of fun,
yeah.
Provided that you have the nostalgia for Magic and don't mind a lot of mechanics.
Yeah, so I mean, knowing all the mechanics, I mean, Time Spiral Block is not for everybody, and it's not something that we can easily do as a normal set these days, but I really, really enjoyed it. I had a blast making it. I mean, Time Spiral was horrendously fun to make.
Yeah.
And it's just fun. It's kind of like... Hey, it's every mechanic you probably have ever seen in Magic all in one set. So that's my personal favorite.
It's the best set with Squire in it.
It is the best Squire set.
Yeah.
I'm also a big fan. I was really, really happy with how Unstable came out. And that's also, as far as recent drafts, that's a set that I've run back
a lot
of times.
Unstable's super fun. Yeah. It's true. Daniel, what about you?
Cons of Dark Hero. Triple all
right.
Cons all the way.
That's all good. Right.
I went to like... every pre-release, I always made a point to like make sure to clear my calendar for the pre-releases, and I was the most excited for Cons, and that's it just like over and over delivered. I was probably at my gaming store every Friday night to draft for that set.
Wow.
Yeah.
Mine's a little bit of weird. It's Shards of Alara block draft. So Shards of Alara, Conflux, Alara Reborn. For one reason, the card Wall of Denial exists in Alara Reborn. Wall of Denial is one of my favorite Magic cards of all time. Because there would always be that one draft of Shards of Alara block where I would get two Wall of Denials.
Oh, even better.
Oh, man. I felt like a monster every time I played one. And when I played two, I felt like an absolute genius for going white-blue early on. And I just have really fond memories of casting Wall of Denial from that format.
It's a 0/8 Shroud for 3 mana.
Shroud Flying insane. Defender. Yeah, Shroud yeah. Flying
insane.
Defender.
Like, yeah,
it's really, really good. It's really good. And then we've also got another question for Mark.
Okay.
How do you balance making the game fun for the player with making the game fun for the opponent? What kind of mechanics do you avoid to keep the fun from being too one-sided?
Hmm. Well, I mean, one of the things that, right, one of the challenges is it is fun to beat your opponent. And so one of the things you gotta be careful of is there are certain things that it's fun to do that it's not that much fun to be have done against you.
Right.
And so one of the things we test all the way through the process is not just were you having fun playing your deck, but were you having fun playing against the other person? And there's a lot of little tiny things we do. There's certain effects. Like, one of the things we've learned is things that keep the opponent from playing the game aren't that much fun. So counterspells and stone rains and hand denial, things that we want in the game, but we want to be careful that, like, there's not so much that I can build a deck of nothing but them and you just can't do anything. And so it's a gentle balance. It's something you want to work. But I mean, when we do testing, when we do drafts, people make notes. One of the things we ask is talk about not just what you enjoyed playing, but what you thought about things being played against you. And that's something we always monitor.
I want to sort of extend a different version of this question to George, because working in video games, how do you keep things challenging against a non-human opponent while still making sure that it's fun to play against a non-human opponent?
So that's where the whole can of worms open.
Like, yeah.
So fun about in games is a lot of times about keeping the challenge level within a certain band, right?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
But you don't know exactly how good at this game your player is going to be. It could be like a whole range of like skill levels, right? So a lot of video game makers use is like kind of this dynamic difficulty adjustment tools where if you're the better, basically the better you're doing at the game kind of scales up the difficulty to match your skill level. And I think you have to be really careful when doing this kind of stuff too, because if I can ever play a video game, like knowing like, okay, if I ever know that the game is very blatantly skilling up to match my skill, then I can just stay at a lower perceived skill level and beat the game quicker that way. So that's like where you have to kind of keep it behind the scenes. I imagine there's a lot of instances of dynamic game design that are just never told to the public. One of the cool, like this past GDC, I went to a talk where they kind of like a lot of game designers divulged a bunch of their secrets. And I'm like, whoa, this is like, but these are for games that have been out for a long time already. But
right.
I just thought like, you know, this is all really cool stuff.
What was the biggest secret you learned?
In BioShock, to make it seem more exciting, the enemy will come and shoot at you, but the first shot always misses, right?
Interesting.
So it seems like they're engaging you right away, but it ups the excitement level without actually making the game more difficult, right? So yeah, I bet there's a ton of those things that have just never seen the light of day, because I think if players know this kind of stuff, it's just like it feels really cheap. It feels like really like you can kind of game the system a lot of times if you know too much too.
Another technique that video games use that I think is interesting is the rating things, where like you do a level and you can get, you know, 1, 2, or 3 stars.
Yeah, I like
and so
that.
The idea
sure,
is
sure.
Like for the lower players, like, well, I just did it. I don't
right.
but the more experienced players, like, well, no, I gotta do it and
yeah.
get
yep.
the 3 stars. And so like it sort of lets people set their own limit for what they want. And it makes, I think it's a cool thing they do in video games to sort of like let people kind of self-set their own levels.
Yeah, when you go for all 3 stars at once and you
yeah.
fail, you only have yourself to blame.
So. You have a little more replay value
yeah.
too.
Exactly.
Experiencing the content.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I think we've got time for one more question. And it's actually a pretty good one to end on. Looking to the future of Magic, is there anything exciting that comes to mind for you, whether it be new advancements in technology or things that we can, things that we can do today that we couldn't do 10 plus years ago?
Well, let me say this. So when George first came, I had to basically say, okay, George, here's the next 2 years worth
yeah.
of Magic.
Yeah.
Right. Like I'll sit you down.
Yeah.
So is there exciting stuff coming in the next 2 years of Magic?
Yeah, I felt like one of the kids visiting Willy Wonka's chocolate factory. It's like, cause like every time a spoiler is posted, like I was like, you know, I'd just be like, oh my God, it's like Christmas, right? I get to read all these cards. So I read like eight sets worth of cards in, yes, in like yes. first yeah. yeah. So oh, there's some awesome stuff coming.
No, you can't. He's not going to say anything. Can't say anything.
I mean, one of the things we're always looking at is how to improve things, how to up things, mm-hmm. Not just design wise, but the whole package and how technology and like, I'm not allowed to say what we're doing, but like, 2 years from now, when you look back and you're like, okay, you're gonna like, oh my goodness, a lot happened in the last 2 years. So there's a lot of exciting things coming. I can't tell you the details, but there's a lot of really exciting things and stuff that I don't think people like from places they're not going to expect it. We're definitely throwing surprises from all sorts of places. So anyway,
To go back to the earlier point about design, though, I think that's the testament of why Magic is what it is, because like 25 years in, we can still say, hey, in the next 2 years, there's so much exciting stuff and so many new developments that are still coming down the pipeline. It's pretty amazing.
So I love that every time we have Mark on and any designer from R&D, that there's just always this big attitude of excitement for the future and things that are coming down the line and how we can't wait to see what our players think about some of the stuff that we're doing now that they're not going to see for 2 years.
Right. So when I hand off a set, it's 2 years before the public sees it. So like,
I mean, you probably knew that coming in, George, but has it really hit you that the stuff you're working on now will not see the light of day? Until like 2 years down the line.
When someone said this set is coming out, in 2020, I was like, that seems so far away. I was like, whoa, yeah.
Well, hopefully when the set comes out, we can have you back onto the show and you can talk about all the work that you actually did while you were here in the building.
That should be really fun.
And it'd be really fun. Yeah. Mark, George, thank you so much for being here. Really appreciate you being guests.
Thanks for having me.
Special thanks to Daniel for filling in for Blake. For those of you that are looking for information about next week, I do have that for you. So next week, we're going to be visiting with Matt Tabak and Melissa DeTora, two people that you might know from Wizards R&D. And you're going to get a first look at the mechanics of Guilds of Ravnica, which is really cool. I'm looking forward to Guilds of Ravnica. I love Ravnica. I know that we have a lot of Ravnica fans here on this set as well. Plus, you're going to get to see a special version of the M-Files live that looks at developer comments for old Ravnica cards that are going to be in the Guilds of Ravnica guild kit. So not only are you going to get to see a first look at the mechanics, you're also going to get a special M-Files that looks at old Ravnica cards, and those cards are going to be previews for what's going to be in the Guilds of Ravnica guild kit. So we really hope that that we're going to be able to fit Tay back into the studio this time.
He's very tall. He's terribly tall.
Yeah, he's very, very tall. But thank you. Thank you all again. Thank you, everybody, for tuning in. Please stay tuned for Kenji Igashira coming up next, streaming some Magic the Gathering. Tune in next week. We hope to see you soon.
Bye-bye.